This is Confessions of a Book Collector. I'm your host, David Headley, and I will be exploring all aspects of publishing and book collecting, interviewing best-selling and upcoming authors, and sharing insights on books both old and new. Welcome back to Confessions of a Book Collector. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Graham Bartlett. Graham rose to become a chief superintendent and divisional commander of Brighton and Hove Police. His first non-fiction book, Death Comes Knocking, was a Sunday Times bestseller, which then followed with Babes in the Wood. He co-wrote those books with best-selling author Peter James. But now Graham, in his own right, is a best-selling and hugely brilliant thriller writer. His first book was called Bad for Good. I like to call it Good for Bad, and Graham keeps correcting me. So sorry about that, Graham. And his next book, his newest book that's just out right now, is called Force of Hate. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you very much, David. I've been looking forward to this.
Have you?
I have, honestly. Speak the truth.
How did you get into writing? Is it because you made friends with Peter James, or did you always want to be a writer?
No, essentially it was because I made friends with Peter James, and he kind of made me an offer I couldn't refuse, to coin a phrase. I'm not that writer that has got 1,500 novels that I've written since the age of seven under my bed or anything like that. I literally was offered by Peter James to help him write a non-fiction, Death Comes Knocking. And I got the bug from that and wrote another one with him, as you say, and then went off on my own to write fiction. And with the aid of a brilliant agent, managed to get published.
And who is this? No, I'm joking. So police procedural is important to you because you've been helping writers for a long time with the procedure. But your books are... I mean, they are amazing and they are police procedural, but they're not really police procedural, are they? That you've separated yourself from what is out there in the market.
Yes, and that was deliberate. I wanted to have an angle to tell a policing story from that no one else had. And having been the chief superintendent at Brighton for 4 years, working in a fiercely political city with lots of issues at a national and local level impacting on policing and the stresses and the conflicts it caused me as the chief of police for the area, I wanted to kind of relate that to a reader, but in a way that speaks to ordinary crime, murders, kidnappings, all of those sorts of things. And nobody else was writing it. So I thought, well, I'm probably one of the only people that could write it.
Absolutely. And one of the things I found really when you approached me for representation, you told me about Bad for Good being this kind of futuristic, but not so far in the future. I mean, we are, I guess, when you pitched this book to me a few years ago, we're practically where we are, right? I mean, Brighton it has a lot of problems. I mean, not as dark as you make it out to be. I live there. It's the most beautiful city. Yeah. But it does have its issues. Did you want to purposefully bring that to the attention of the public, or is it about the cuts to the police, the political side of it?
Or both? A bit of both, really. Yeah. I wanted to I wanted to write fiction. I wanted to write thrillers that people would love, pick up, not be able to put down. But also I wanted to kind of show people, you know, what could happen if things carry on on the trajectory that we were on. You know, the police has been cut, as have every other public sector, to the bone and expected to do more. And Bad for Good is in some way a warning as to where that could end up. And in the same way, Force of Hate is a warning about unfettered power and what happens if we kind of sleepwalk our way into extremist administrations.
Do you want to tell the audience about Force of Hate and Bad for Good? I mean, Bad for Good introduces us to Joe Howe. Do you want to tell the readers how you've progressed her from the very first book?
Yeah, so Joe Howe is the protagonist in the book and in the series, and she we meet her when she is called to a murder scene, and it turns out the person that is murdered is the son of the divisional commander at the time at Brighton and a person whom she had an affair with. So there's a very deep professional and personal angst with her. She, because of what happens, she reluctantly becomes the chief superintendent at Brighton and finds that the cupboard is bare, that there are no officers or very few officers, they're being run ragged, and more to the point is that there is a gang of vigilantes who are kind of filling the gap that the police can't. So the public business people are phoning vigilantes as opposed to the police to sort out their problems because the police have failed them. And she realizes that actually this is endemic, and there are very wicked things happening to quite bad people, but they're happening anyway, all the while trying to investigate this murder and trying to work out where the high-level corruption's coming in.
You take Joe with the second book into another area of travellers, and you get even more dark with the second book, don't you?
I do. I mean, the second book starts off with a firebomb attack on a traveller's site, and Joe quickly realises that the neo-Nazi council that have been dubiously elected, and there's an inquiry going on into election rigging, she realises they're behind it. And almost by chance, but not, she also discovers there is a flood of human trafficking victims coming into the city, and we meet a girl by the name of Aji, who's a qualified nurse, come over here to flee the war in Syria, and finds herself locked into slavery in a care home where old people are being killed and left to die in order to fund what will become a huge terrorist atrocity.
Do you know where you're going with the third book?
The same darkness. I mean, Brighton has a number of issues, not least the fact that it's for a long time had the moniker of being the drugs death capital of the UK. It has a huge number of, at one point it had per capita more injecting drug addicts than London and Liverpool. And that was kind of my life for sort of about 6 years, really trying to manage that. So the fourth book is looking at that and the influences of more of private industry.
The third book. I'm going to say, have I not read the book yet?
The third book is about that and the influences of big pharmaceutical companies to sustain the drugs market in Brighton in order to sustain their business.
And I ask you that, even though I've read it, but I wanted you to explain to the reader. Yes, I have. Do you want to reveal the title, or do you want to keep that under wraps?
Well, the title at the moment is, which we're very happy with, I think, nodding over there, yes, we are happy with it, is City on Fire.
Yes.
And it describes really, you know, after three books, how the city's functioning. I've got no idea. But I'm really excited about it. It's an area that I worked in very closely, did a lot of work around changing the police approach to drug addiction, drug use, not treating it so much as a crime, more as a medical issue, and received quite a lot of criticism for that in my day job.
Really? It's so interesting hearing you talk about Brighton in a way that, because I live there and I never see that side of it that you do as a police officer or did. I must walk around with blinkers on because I just think it's the most beautiful, amazing, open, progressive city. But it's clearly got its undertones of darkness.
I think if you speak to any police officer that's worked in an area for a length of time and ask them what that area's like, they'll suck their teeth. You know, and I remember when I was doing some work around safeguarding, there was somebody that was moving over from Kent to work as an assistant director in the council for children's services. And she was desperate to find somewhere to live. She knew she was looking for a house. And so she said to me, "Sure, I've got some details here of places that, you know, that the agent sent me. Can we go through them?" I said, "Yeah, let's grab a coffee." So we're going through them. And every single one, I was like, "Oh, I remember a rape there. Oh, there was a murder there. Or I remember an arson just down the road from that one." And in the end, she just stood up and walked away because she said, I can't live in this city, can I?" I said, no. I said, "I just see it through a certain lens. It is a beautiful city. It is a very open, welcoming city, but it has a very, very dark side to it that thankfully most people don't see. And I'm glad you don't see it."
No, well, I mean, I think I walk around with blinkers. And I live in central London too half of the week, so it's kind of like I don't see I'm sure that the police around here see a lot more things than I don't want to see them. I read about it in books, and that's as much as I want to experience. As your agent, it really is exciting to see how you have progressed your writing career and how people have responded to your books. some of the reviews you've had, I mean, the Daily Mail says dark, brutal, and laced with violence. It's such an impressive quote. Mark Billingham saying, as next cop, Graham Bartlett knows what he's talking about, and he certainly knows how to tell a good story. I mean, you really do. Your writing is brilliant. You write really page-turning, thrilling stories. And I guess my favourite quote from S.A. Cosby is, Falsifer is a masterful examination of the darkness that exists in the souls of the morally broken. Such a great quote.
I had a real chill when he sent that through. First of all, I had a chill that he'd read it. And secondly, that he was good enough to send a quote. Because I think Razorblade Tears is the standout book of the last few years for me.
He's such a great writer. Mm. And I'm going to come on to that about reading and books and what they mean to you, because obviously Confessions of a Book Collector is about books. How do you feel? How does it make you feel having left the police force, not really knowing, because you didn't plan to become a novelist. So how do you feel now that you are and getting such credit for writing?
I think, like many writers, I have acute imposter syndrome, and particularly coming to it so late in life. You know, I sort of take the plaudits with a bit of, okay, thank you, are you sure, kind of thing. But I am, you know,
is that because you're too modest, Graham?
Well, maybe. But I'm immensely grateful to people like you and Alison and Busby and my editor Susie Dunlop there, and many, many others, including, you know, very well established authors who, you know, I've helped on the procedure, and they've helped me not only in terms of the books but also my writing routines, you know, the kind of theory of story behind it, so I kind of understand a little bit more about how to structure, What struck me more than anything, I think, it coming into this community is how friendly, how welcoming, how accepting, and how helpful everybody is. You know, everyone, you know, I don't know about other genres, everyone I've met in the crime genre wants everyone to do well. We're all each other's cheerleaders.
I think that's absolutely true. My experience of bookselling for the last 25 years is that people have, in the crime community, been very supportive of each other. I do think that there are other organisations that help. I guess the Historical Writers Association are also supportive of each other, but the crime writing community is incredibly, incredibly passionate to support each other. And there's so many great crime writers that do want to pull up people behind them. And I think that's remarkable.
And I think part of it, I remember sitting at Capital Crime last year in many panels, listening to kind of household names, you know, people that, you know, you see their books in shops on the other side of the world, talking about imposter syndrome, talking about needing the support of others, talking about thinking that their next book is the one that's going to find them out. And it's really reassuring that they're able to share those vulnerabilities that, you know, I consider myself a novice at this, or certainly, you know, an apprentice or just coming out of my apprenticeship, that I share as well. So you just think, actually, it's normal to feel like that. You know, it's a lonely job. You know, you have lots of people around you, but actually when you're sat at the desk, it's you and the screen. And I'm used to a world where even when I was, you know, in my most senior role, I could rely on immediate, sometimes subtle, but immediate feedback as to whether I was bonkers in making this decision, or that, you know, we've tried that and done that before. Or, you know, I could tell by the look in someone's eye. I've got no idea what my books are like until somebody else reads them, by which time I'm a nervous wreck.
I know. Well, you pester me until I've read your books, and because you're desperate to hear my feedback on it.
Pestering?
Yeah. Well,
reminding.
No. Well, you talked about S.A. Cosby's Razorblade Tears. I mean, do you read a lot? Do you have a chance to read?
Because
but I know that you're reading books to read for the procedure and correcting writers. But do you read for pleasure too?
I find it harder now to read for pleasure. And that doesn't mean I don't enjoy the reading that I do. I rarely get the chance to pick up a book because I want to read it, and I've got bookshelves full of books that I must get round to reading. But I read, I read because I advise authors. So I've always got manuscripts on the go where I'm kind of advising and editing and feeding back on police procedure and police structures and characters and that sort of thing. I'm judging for the Crime Writers Association nonfiction Dagger, so I've got all of those to read, and you know I'm very lucky to be sent you know a lot of books, a lot of advanced reader copies with a view to quoting on. So it's rare that I get a chance to think, oh, I fancy reading that and give it a go. But talking Razor Blade Tears was one of those that I did, and I bought it having met Sean at Capital Crime, and a few days later we were going away on holiday, and I took it with some other books that I wanted to read just for its own sake, and was blown away by it.
Did you enjoy Capital Crime? Because I thought that your panel was brilliant, actually. I listened, because we recorded all of them, and I re-listened to them. Did you enjoy that? Because it was very different putting three police officers, ex-police officers, together to try and solve a crime. And I thought Erin Kelly was amazing.
Yeah, no, she did a really good job. And it was a, you know, what a privilege to be on a panel with Erin, who I've known anyway because I've run courses with her, and Colin Sutton, who is probably this country's most successful senior investigating officer and now crime writer and advises TV as well, and John Sutherland, who again, an incredible crime writer, and somebody who will say to people that he saved my life at the Emirates Stadium when he was a superintendent and I was a chief superintendent. But John has, so, and we all got a very slightly different take on policing, very slightly different experiences. So it was really good to bring all those together in the way that we did. And we're great friends anyway, so great. It made it easy.
It really came across, but it was such a great idea of Lizzie to try and do something different. I think the thing about Capital Crime is there's lots of crime festivals, but how do you keep it fresh and entertaining for the readers? And that's what I always wanted to achieve.
Well, I remember
achieve.
The first one I did, when my job was to interrogate Mark Billingham about whether or not he was actually a crime writer or just a ghostwriter. It was a brilliant concept. Not helped by the fact that I forgot the caution at the very first moment, but that broke the ice a little bit, I think. He did say to me before, I'm not going to admit anything unless I feel I have to. And he did admit it, so I must have done something right.
Good. No, I mean, I think that's probably when I first met you.
Probably was, yeah.
That was such a great thing, and hopefully you'll attend Capital Crime again this year.
Definitely.
Talk to me about books and what they mean to you. Did you read as a kid? What do books mean to you? What have they always meant to you?
But I mean, I did read as a kid. You know, I read a lot. But you know, even though I had no notion of being a writer until very late on, I've always loved books. Books have been my go-to place, and I'm sure you're the same. That you know, I'll look at my bookshelf, and I just get this kind of warm feeling, this excited feeling about all of these worlds that I can go into. And for the reasons I explained a minute ago, I don't get to go into all of them all the time. But I love finding new writers, and I love finding new series. And I've been so fortunate to have just read Mike Craven's Fearless, which is the beginning of a new series.
I know Mike emailed me yesterday and told me what you said. He said
I'm going to repeat all of it on here.
You said something about your boots, and he said it must be a southern turn of phrase. I'd never heard of it, though.
Have you not?
No.
All right.
Do you remember what you said?
Yeah, exactly what I said.
This is a clean podcast.
Yeah. It might be. Maybe it is a southern
thing. I'd never heard of it, but it is. Said it's a southern thing that they
it was
say.
A compliment, just in case you
no 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 he knew it. He knew it was, well, it was such a gracious your quote was amazing, and
something like it's reacher but without the fluffy bits.
Yes, yeah, there's no fluffy
so
bits
hard,
yeah Fearless is amazing. I'm very excited about it, but thank you for giving him a quote for that. Do you remember the book that you read as a child that influence you to read more? I always ask this question because I, you know, as a person who reads so many books, I still remember the book that made me the bookworm that I am. Mm. Was there one particular book as a young
kid? There was. And it wasn't a crime. It was When the Lion Feeds by Wilbur Smith.
Oh, wow.
I was so sad when he died. Was it last year or the year before? I love Wilbur Smith's books. I probably didn't know why I loved it when I was reading it. But looking back at the way that he kind of evokes these huge, expansive, worlds that were that are a million miles from anything that I know. You know, the sort of Southern African kind of velds and all of the kind of colonialism that's going on, and of course going back further into his Egyptian series. You know,
I love those Egyptian series.
Oh, is it just amazing? And I talk about getting lost in worlds. I literally got lost in worlds there, and I would just, you know, go back to that book and read it and read it and read it. And I think probably reading great authors like that is one of the reasons why I thought, well, I could never do that, you know, and I probably can't. Well, I can't, but you know, you just look at people like Wilbur Smith and how, you know, he does create these fabulous worlds and this imagery with, you know, really kind of pacey, thrilling stories in the back of it. And yeah, the Egyptian stories are amazing.
It's so nice for someone to talk about Wilbur Smith, because I've read a lot of Wilbur Smith and he's not talked about in the way that one would have thought he would be. I know he's an amazing storyteller, and you know, people are still continuing to write the books around his, I guess he's come up with the ideas and people are continuing to write them, but he was such a brilliant, clever storyteller, adventure storyteller. I read loads as a kid, loads. I read all of the Egyptian ones because I adore the Egyptian ones, but I read all about the Courtenays, and they just, you're right. Like they you were lost in those books for days, weren't you?
Yeah. Do you think it's a kind of UK thing, or do you think, because, you know, I don't know. I would guess that sort of in Africa, maybe, where people recognise the worlds a little bit more. But I think we're missing a trick by not reading Wilbur Smith.
Yeah, no. Well, there's lots of authors that I think people don't read anymore and they're out of fashion. But I'm not saying that's true of Wilbur Smith, because he's still right. The books are still being published and they're still bestsellers. But certainly it's been a long time since somebody ever recommended a Wilbur Smith to me.
Right.
And that makes me sad. Mm. Because I just think I cut my teeth on reading those like you did. And, you know, I it's just wonderful for me. Anyway, it's wonderful for me to hear Wilbur Smith being told as an inspiration, because I thought he was a remarkable writer.
No, absolutely.
I met him and his wife at Goldsborough. We did a party and he came along, and I had met him prior in the Seychelles a long time ago when he was previously married to another writer, but she died, Danielle, and she was also a novelist, Danielle Thomas, and so I didn't meet him properly, so it wasn't like he would ever remember me, but I think he was the first writer that I'd met where I thought they were a superstar.
Right.
And that kind of, because I do think writers are superstars. I get starstruck when I meet writers, and I get all dry mouth and I don't know what to say to them because I love their books so much.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I thought your battle hardened today.
No. If I've read a book and I really, really love it, I'm a bit nervous about meeting the writer still. Oh. Just because I don't want to say anything that would be bad, or I don't want them to say something that would make me not love them as much as I do. I mean, I don't know them as a person, but I love their books so much. So does that make sense? I don't know if I'm waffling on.
No more than usual.
So talk to me about the books that you've read recently that you have really loved reading.
I've talked about Razorblade Tears and Blacktop Wasteland. I read again, you know, great character-led books there. I read, again, a lot of these haven't come out yet, but The Final Party by A.A. Chowdhury.
Oh, yes.
Comes out in May. That's absolutely stunning. I sort of described it in my quote back to her as kind of, you know, waiting for the bomb to explode, but not knowing, you know, how many pieces it would go into. It's a bit of a locked room story set in Italy, but refers back to events that happened in Oxford. Oxford before that. As I say, Fearless was absolutely fabulous. You know, love that. God, I'm just trying to think. I've read so many. I'm just trying to think of other ones that I've. Jack Jordan's new one.
Conviction.
Yeah. What a story that
is. He's such a great writer, isn't he? Incredible. And he's one of the nicest men too.
Yeah. No, I raced through that one. It was just, you know, and of course, you know, I love a courtroom drama because I'm familiar with that world. But, you know, this was so much more than a courtroom drama. And he did it with Do No Harm as well. You know, he puts his protagonists in the most impossible situations you could ever wish to be put into. And I don't want to give anything away on either of those books, but he never ceases to surprise the reader right to the very, very last dot on the page.
And I
remember thinking, like you said, you're such a nice bloke. How on earth do you do this? Where does that streak come from?
But I think that's true of most writers. I mean, you're one of the nicest men I've ever met, and yet you write very, very dark thrillers. You put your protagonist through hell.
Mm. Yeah, maybe that's where I get rid of my anger. I mean, it's interesting what I do with the protagonist, because I realised that I was putting her through hell, and I actually felt sorry for her. And I think, well, why am I feeling sorry for her? Because it's me that's doing it to her. But when I was writing Force of Hate, I thought, God, she's been through so much in Bad for Good. I need to get a psychologist in, not to help me, but to help her. I might need one for me as well. So I spoke to Chris Merritt, who's an incredible crime writer in his own right. But he's also a clinical psychologist who specializes in trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. So I got him to read it through, and because I didn't want Joe to come away completely unscathed from all the terrible things that have happened to her and things she's had to do in book one. But I didn't want it to be a PTSD story either. So I just wanted her to have traits of her, just the scars really of things that she's done. So little kind of hints that things weren't going quite so well in her head and that she was compensating for certain things. And I've done the same in book three as well, because I think it's important to, if I'm reading a character, I want to believe in that character. You know, they don't have to be somebody that I can relate to personally, but I need to find them credible. And I thought with Joe being a strong but slightly reluctant, self-doubting senior police officer, and having gone through everything that it takes for a woman to get to that level, she needed to have some impact of, I say, the terrible things. So hopefully I'm treating her well, because I'm actually recognising that, but she is getting through an awful lot of wine at the moment.
I mean, there's a lot of writers who I know who are the most kind people, but actually put their protagonists through, hell. And they've got very dark imaginations, which I obviously admire, but also a little bit frightened of. This is Confessions of a Book Collector, and we always go into the confessional, and I'm sorry about this, but I'm going to put you on the spot, and I'm going to ask you to tell me, there's one book in your house, hopefully, that you love. It's one book that you, if you have to ever leave your house, and I hope this never happens, but if you have to ever leave your house and you can only take one book with you, what would it be?
Well, funny, I thought you might ask that.
Yeah, because I ask everyone.
Yeah. I do listen. I thought about it, because I think, like so many of your guests, I'd say, well, I'll take the lot, I'll just get a furniture van. But if I was to be forced into one, which I think I am, I think it's got to be The Godfather.
Oh, amazing. It is an amazing book.
I think it is an incredible book. And it's a book that I can read time and time again, because I find different layers to it every time I read it. And I've read it years ago, and I've read it recently, now understanding a little bit about story and about character development and just kind of seeing, the way what happens with Michael Corleone and because first you think, oh, the story's about Vito, and it's not. It's Michael's story and the inversion that happens to him. And every time I read it, I find something different. And then I think you recommended The Offer.
Have you watched it?
Yeah, I did.
It's amazing. Oh, I've never watched anything more shocking in my life.
It's incredible.
Not round a book.
No, you just think, one of the century's greatest movies, an absolute powerhouse of a film, nearly never got made because of the mafia influence, and then what Al Ruddy had to do to get to get to the point
where I should explain to the listener that there is a movie on Paramount. It's not a movie, it's a TV
it's
series,
a TV series, yeah.
With Miles Teller in it, and he plays the main protagonist, who is the film director of The Godfather, and it's the journey that he has to go on to make the movie of The Godfather, and everybody wants to try and stop him making this movie. Yeah. and the mafia get involved, and Frank Sinatra gets it. Who knew that he was so dark? It's quite an extraordinary movie series. It feels like a movie. It was just one of the best things I've watched on TV for such a long time. Well, I love The Godfather, and I love that whole series, and it excites me talking to you, because you're talking about books that really have inspired me. You know, just I love those books, both of Wilbur Smith books and Mario Puzo's book is amazing. You would take that then, The Godfather?
Yeah,
you take that.
Definitely. And I would read it and reread it and reread it. And I think the kind of common denominator between the books that I've been talking about and I know we've talked about, you know, separately as well, is that they're more than just the story. You know, the stories are fine. You know, I mean, you know, certainly with my background, I could write a murder story. You know, I've got so much kind of material that I can draw, and I could write a murder mystery, you know, and whether I'd write it well or not is for other people to decide. But I think, you know, depth of character, key messages, you know, all these kind of things that get you kind of thinking long after you've turned the page. I mean, I watched, again, it wasn't a book, but it was a movie, Banshees of Inisherin, recently. I can't get that out of my head. Just thinking about what that film is all about, and the complexities of what
all those characters,
very simple characters, but actually the deep complexities and some of the dialogue and the meaning and that's what I love in books is to think, oh my God, you know, and all the books I've mentioned today have that kind of those layers, that depth, that
life changing, No, I agree with you. I mean, that movie is extraordinary. Like you, I couldn't get it out of my head for days, because it's quite dark but funny,
but
dark.
Funny, yeah.
Yeah, and when you say you love it, you feel a bit guilty for loving it because it is really dark. But it is really quite remarkable.
Where he's kind of directing the other musicians. I don't know if it's giving it away, but because he's got no fingers, and you know, it's just hilarious. But it's incredibly dark.
Spoiler alert. Thank you, Graham, for coming to talk to me. I wanted to talk to you for ages, and we've been planning this, but we've finally done it. Thank you. I do think that your books are really amazing, and I really mean that. I think that you're such a gifted storyteller. Bad for Good is out in paperback now, and Force of Hate is in hardback, and City on Fire will be out next year. I'm so excited to see what happens with this series, because it is really a fantastic series.
Thank you, and thanks for making it happen for me.
Subscribe now to be one of the first to hear our new series, and follow Goldsborough Books on socials to keep up to date with our latest news and to discover who will be joining me on Confessions of a Book Collector, your new favourite podcast.